This is The Guardian.
I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. Right now, the Northern Territory is facing crises on multiple fronts.
A lot's going on. The Northern Territory is in the middle of its worst COVID outbreak so far in this pandemic. To make matters worse for poor old Central Australia, where there are a lot of cases popping up, there's flooding, which has isolated a number of smaller communities and is making it really difficult for food to be delivered and for supplies to be delivered, medical supplies. So even, you know, the big organisations like Outback Stores, they service, I think it's 46 remote communities that supply them with groceries and necessities. And they're saying that they've got big logistical challenges in supplying food because of the flooding, closing roads.
Lorena Allam is Guardian Australia's Indigenous Affairs editor, and she's been speaking to people on the ground in the Northern Territory.
And what's more, I think it's becoming clear that governments and many communities are just not prepared to deal with this magnitude of outbreak.
Late last year, the Territory recorded its first death from COVID-19. And now, with around 1,000 cases being recorded each day, the death toll is continuing to rise, with 5 deaths so far, all of them Aboriginal. Today, how the Northern Territory lost control of COVID-19. It's Wednesday, the 9th of February. So, Lorena, what is happening right now on the ground in the NT, especially in some of these remote communities that have been hit really hard by COVID?
We're hearing some pretty dire reports. So last week in Yuendumu, we heard the story of an elderly woman who tested positive for COVID and in order to protect the rest of her family had been sleeping outside on the veranda for several nights and spending her days isolating under a tree to keep the rest of her family safe. Now, her niece was really distressed about the fact that her auntie had to do that. She herself is caring for a toddler and she has a partner with diabetes who is on dialysis 3 times a week. So extremely risky for them to have a COVID positive person in their care. And she was saying to me that she was getting really mixed messages from health professionals about what to do. She thought there should be a place in town for people, COVID-positive people, to isolate. There wasn't anything like that in Yuendumu. And she was also very worried about her auntie being able to get the right medical care. She was coughing and unwell. She had some of the, you know, more unpleasant symptoms of COVID. So very alarming for that family. There was also another situation at Yuendumu where a group of people who were taken to the Alice Springs quarantine facility as potential close contacts were sent home a day or two early. The local authorities said they hadn't been told these people were coming back and they went back to their homes and by the time the local health group got to them, they had tested COVID positive and potentially infected all the other people that lived in their house. So the local health officials were really upset about that and concerned that that was a bit of an error that made matters worse. Also, the community of Bloodawatch, which is 350 kilometres northeast of Alice Springs, they've been without road access for more than a week because of the floods, you know, and the heavy rain. They were also dealing with their first COVID-19 outbreak with just 5 medical staff to care for about 600 potential patients and not enough rapid antigen tests. And the food security was looking pretty dire as well. So ultimately, these are remote communities who are already impoverished, who are already going without the things that we in the cities take for granted. And COVID has just hit them like a truck and made everything a whole lot worse.
Right, so what restrictions have the Territory government put in place to try and control this outbreak?
They've slowly brought in tougher and tougher restrictions. They reintroduced a mask mandate on New Year's Eve after, you know, extended public pressure about that. And then in early January, they implemented a snap statewide lockout, which essentially meant vaccinated people could move around freely, but unvaccinated people could only leave their house for essential reasons. And then in mid-January, they moved to snap lockdowns in certain communities that were experiencing outbreaks like Gullawinku, Yirrkala, Yuendumu, and then Lajamanu most recently. But these measures were confusing. People couldn't understand the difference. What was the difference between a lockout and a lockdown? What did that mean in a remote community? And eventually, I mean, it appeared that these measures weren't really enough, that COVID had got out and beyond them by the time these measures were introduced. So then at the urging of those organisations working on the front lines, the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisations, last week the federal government announced that they would put in place a biosecurity zone to limit travel in and around remote areas of the Northern Territory.
Tell me about these biosecurity zones, Serena. How exactly do they work?
It's not the first time they've happened. So early in the COVID outbreak, the federal government declared biosecurity zones around the top end, based on, interestingly, the fact that when the virus was first here in Australia, a lot of remote communities took matters into their own hands early and just locked themselves down. They're allowed to issue permits to people. So they just said, we're not issuing permits to anyone. We're going to stay here and stay safe. And the biosecurity zones were put together to help protect them. Mm. What they basically do is make sure that no one can go in or out without a special permit and without being tested and cleared of COVID. So The biosecurity zones are in place until the 17th of February to help them get the vaccination rates up, you know, help them get a handle on exactly how many cases they've got to deal with.
So, Lorena, despite these measures, cases and deaths have been growing over the past few months, and the Northern Territory is in the middle of their worst outbreak of the pandemic so far. What went wrong here?
Well, see, this is the thing. I mean, the Territory government is saying it hasn't fallen apart. They're saying everything's fine. Mm. So there's a bit of dissonance between what the community-controlled sector is saying and what the Territory government is saying, and inside there is the tension. But the reason the Territory has done very well is because the border was closed for such a long time. No one could go in and out. And traditional owners, as I said before, had made early decisions to lock themselves down because they understood how vulnerable they were to this disease. And that was all extremely successful. And in fact, they were the envy of the rest of us. You know, people in the top end were leading relatively normal lives while the rest of us were in lockdown. But they kept saying that this virus was coming. There was an inevitability about this, and so they needed to be ready. Late last year, I was speaking to John Patterson, the head of AMSANT, the Aboriginal Medical Services of the Northern Territory, and they represent, you know, hundreds and hundreds of traditional owners and the frontline medical services who are on limited resources dealing with these outbreaks. And at that time, November, he was saying the Territory government was excluding them from high-level emergency planning about the COVID outbreak, which was really frustrating. And he said he was, you know, getting angry about the fact that he was essentially having to find out about crucial decisions via the media. He said to me he heard the Territory government announce their measures on the news.
What type of decisions was he talking about?
Well, for one, the NT government decided on a December deadline for reopening the borders, which was, you know, all the premiers had agreed to that deadline. And the NT stuck to that deadline despite the fact that Patterson and others had said it was putting unnecessary pressure on the frontline health workers to make sure that the vaccinations had risen. He said really there wasn't enough time for them to get enough first doses and then enough second doses into people who'd already got their first dose to make sure that COVID wasn't going to have a really catastrophic effect on people when it did arrive.
Mm. So what did the government have to say about this claim, that they weren't consulting properly with key Aboriginal organisations on this decision and on others?
The Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, didn't respond directly to AMSANT's claims that it had been locked out of meetings. He said in a statement to us that he was thankful to AMSANT for all the work it had done on remote territory vaccine rollouts and since the vaccine was approved, and said that the Territory had shared their supply of vaccines with AMSANT. And the NT's acting chief health officer, Dr. Charles Payne, said that AMSANT's advice was very much welcome, was the quote, at public health advisory meetings that he convened. And he did seek their advice on a whole range of things, but he said it was not his role to meet with them formally.
Right. So late last year, Aboriginal health organisations are saying they're not being consulted, they don't want the border to open just yet. What happens next?
Well, the Omicron variant had emerged by then. But despite that, on the 20th of December, the Territory government went ahead with opening the borders. So cases went from the single digits to the hundreds in the space of maybe a few weeks, which, you know, was alarming to people. It just kept spreading and spreading. The other crucial thing that didn't happen early on was a mask mandate. So the territory government didn't have a mask mandate when it opened the borders. That meaning, you know, you had to wear a mask in public. The mask mandate was introduced later on, by which time, according to the medical services, the virus had already spread.
So, Lorena, you've been speaking to the three biggest Aboriginal organisations in the Northern Territory, AMSANT, the Central Land Council and Congress Aboriginal Health Service, and they recently wrote a letter to the NT Chief Minister detailing how they felt about the government's COVID response so far. What did they say?
They're saying there was this failure to implement and carry out the emergency plans that had been made well in advance of this current outbreak. It was a very scathing letter. They said, quote, "There has been a catastrophic failure by government to discharge its responsibility to all Northern Territory residents by implementing these plans in Central Australia."
So what are these emergency plans that the Aboriginal health organisations say were essentially abandoned or not properly implemented?
We only know so much about these plans, obviously. We know that they exist. We know the broad strokes of them, which are that they involve taking people who were infected with COVID-19 out of their communities to isolate to Howard Springs in the top end and Alice Springs in the centre. But at the end of January, the Chief Medical Officer of the NT, Hugh Heggie, announced that they were moving to testing and home isolation as the key strategy, which made a lot of people in communities very nervous.
Tell me about home isolation and why it might be so problematic for communities in the NT.
I mean, the key problem is that there can be up to 20 people sharing a three-bedroom house. So there isn't a lot of room to isolate in a situation like that. There's one kitchen. If you're all sharing that same kitchen, the chances of you communicating the virus are that much higher. A lot of homes only have one functioning bathroom. So it's very difficult for people who are positive and people who are their family to not come into contact with one another. And the thing is, the government was well aware with these issues around home isolation. In fact, their own workers were raising concerns about it in mid-January.
What do you mean? What warnings did they have from their own workers?
In every community, there's an emergency response planning group, and it's made up of the crucial emergency workers. So the health clinic, nurses and doctors, the NT police, community representatives, the education department, and even in some cases, the Ken Wyatt, the federal minister's own department will attend. So it's people who represent governments and you know, health teams. In Yundamu, in Central Australia, we saw the minutes of a meeting that was held in mid-January where all those people agreed that home isolation was an urban response that just was not working for Yundamu, and they were really concerned that it was just causing COVID to spread.
Next, the Northern Territory's approach to living with COVID in 2022. So, Lorena, there's a lot of accusations being levelled at the Northern Territory government here. I mean, what have they said about them? What's their assessment of their own response?
I have approached them several times with lots of very specific questions about the cases that have been reported to us, like those cases I mentioned in Yundamu. While they did not respond to any of those specific questions, they did say that they were confident that the health response is appropriate. So last week, the Northern Territory Chief Minister Michael Gunner said to the media, who asked him about the cases in Yundamu, that the Territory Government's response was, quote, "the best in the world."
Right now, if you look at our caseload, the prevalence of COVID, how we're managing it, if you look at other jurisdictions and how they're handling it and compare them to the Territory and taking into account all our vulnerabilities, the Territory response remains the best in the world.
And then later he also said that people might be panicking unnecessarily about the caseload that the Territory has.
There are people, some with very loud voices, who would like you to think that every case of COVID is a catastrophe and everybody should be taken out of their home and put into a hospital. Their heart is in the right place, but a response like that will be the medical equivalent of panic buying.
It's an interesting difference because the frontline workers in the Aboriginal health sector are saying this is a catastrophe. This is really bad. We need help. We need it now. And then on the other side, you have the Northern Territory Chief Minister saying everything's fine. It's not as bad as you think. Our health response is measured and proportionate.
We now have widespread transmission of Omicron through the Territory, just as we expected, and we are managing it just as we prepared for.
So I imagine that part of the reason that the NT Chief Minister is calling for calm is because we are dealing with the milder Omicron variant. I mean, how much of a risk is the Omicron variant for Aboriginal people?
I'm not a medical expert, so it's hard for me to say. But on the face of it, it's not a mild disease for Aboriginal people, particularly people who live in remote communities with comorbidities, who have diabetes, who have rheumatic heart disease and other health problems. And studies have shown that if you get coronavirus and you have cancer or chronic kidney disease, you have diabetes or hypertension, then you are most at risk of death and having severe COVID. Mm. There's also evidence that if you're a renal patient, you're more likely to have long or severe COVID. So generally, Aboriginal people have diabetes at 5 times the rate of non-Aboriginal Australians. And indications of chronic kidney disease among Aboriginal people are at 40% compared to just 9% for non-Indigenous Australians nationally. Mm. So there's a huge disparity there in the severity of the kind of underlying health conditions that they like to talk about that give people a greater risk of dying from this thing. And of all the people who've died in the NT, they're all Aboriginal, all elderly Aboriginal people.
So these comments from the NT Chief Minister don't really address the fact that 30% of his population are Aboriginal and may have a bunch of other health conditions that they're dealing with. A COVID outbreak is just very different within this population, right?
On the face of it, yes. And it also may well be the case that he's absolutely right and that he is acting on the best possible and very, very good health advice. But it appears that that health advice isn't being communicated to the sector in a way that they can understand. I mean, if the Territory government is correct and this is all going to blow over and it's not as bad as everyone thinks, then certainly that message isn't getting through to the people on the front line, is it?
So the Northern Territory Health Minister, Natasha Files, says it's likely that cases are close to peaking across the territory. I mean, from the people you've spoken to, Lorena, what does the next few weeks or even, you know, this year look like in the Northern Territory?
Well, there's so much uncertainty about how to go forward. It may well be true that cases are peaking, and if so, that would be fantastic. So the Territory will have got through this first stage of emergency response. According to Congress and others, we won't see how bad the infections are for another 2 weeks because there's such a delay in testing. Mm. So they may well peak in the next fortnight. But now COVID will be endemic in Aboriginal communities that, as we know, are suffering from all sorts of other endemic health issues, a strained and under-resourced workforce. So what is the planning going to be for future months of living with COVID? Mm. And what does that look like for remote communities with all of these underlying problems that need to be addressed? The communication set between the Territory government and the community-controlled health sector seems to be pretty bad at the moment. So how are they going to mend those fences in order to work together to manage COVID for remote communities? I mean, all those questions are as yet unanswered.
Mm. What can the NT government do right now to get a better grip on this crisis?
They need to get their booster rates up and the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisations have said many times they need a surge workforce to help them do that because while they're administering vaccines and boosters, they've still got their regular clinic caseload to deal with. Mm. There are regions still where the booster rate is less than 5%, so that needs to be really sped up and that requires a workforce but also the resources to do that. And just this weekend, just gone, AMSANT was calling for isolation hubs to be established for the next 12 months or so. So the isolation hubs would be places in the community where people who test positive or are close contacts can safely go and quarantine without having to be taken out of the community. And they want the Territory government to set those up immediately.
It strikes me that a lot of the issues that we've been speaking about, Lorena, you know, chronic health conditions, overcrowding, lack of access to fresh food, are really long-standing and systemic. I mean, the roots of this crisis, is it fair to say that the roots of this crisis start a long time ago and go much broader, really, than the NT government?
We all know the whole world has seen how COVID exploits pre-existing vulnerabilities in our social and economic and health systems. But in the Aboriginal people's case, the vulnerabilities are endemic systemic problems, not of their own making. They are poorly maintained housing, overcrowding, you know, a lack of access to decent, healthy food. And Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations have been warning governments about this since the start of the pandemic. So to see it continue to play out for them must be incredibly frustrating. And I think if you look at it from that perspective, which a lot of the Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations up there are doing, they're asking questions like, why is it that we have to put up with these conditions? Why are the plans for us different? When you look at the effort that is put into urban and regional communities when there's an outbreak, when you compare, you know, the way that Aboriginal people are treated in remote areas. I mean, it is a very stark reminder of the huge disparity and disadvantage that people in remote communities face.
That was Sabrina Allam, the Indigenous Affairs Editor at Guardian Australia. We've linked to her reporting on this issue on the Full Story page, including her piece, Catastrophic Failure, COVID Out of Control in the NT, Say Aboriginal Groups. That piece gives more detail about the letter the Aboriginal Health Organisation sent to the NT Chief Minister's office. Just a note on this episode, an earlier version incorrectly stated that 90% of COVID-19 cases in the Northern Territory are Aboriginal, rather than 90% of COVID patients in Northern Territory hospitals. Also, in response to questions about the use of home isolation, slow contact tracing, delayed introduction of mask mandates, and a failure to remove positive cases from households during this outbreak, a spokeswoman for the NT government said in a statement, "The current stage of the COVID-19 pandemic is challenging for everyone in the territory, and it provides particular challenges for those living and working in remote communities. With the territory's vaccination rates high in a majority of locations, this is significantly reducing the risk of severe disease and hospitalisations. However, we know that hospitalisation rates remain higher among Aboriginal Territorians. Therefore, our focus must be on identifying our most vulnerable, as well as patients that develop more severe disease, and to offer them the treatment they need as early as possible. To achieve this, the approach is a focus to provide care as close to home as possible and move away from removing well cases from communities. The priority is to ensure that our resources are dedicated to those who require acute care, to provide the best and more proportionate response to Territorians, and to ensure that we use our resources in the most effective and sustainable manner." This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, Laura Briley-Newton and Jane Lee. Sound design and mixing by Camilla Hannon. Full Story's executive producers are Miles Muttignoni, Gabrielle Jackson and me, Laura Murphy-Oates. Okay, catch you next time.